But I'll be talking about trends and database research. I think I'll talk about the ones that I find more interesting. If somebody else was giving a similar talk, it could end up being completely different. At least these ones, I find it very exciting. I won't talk so much about products. Don't expect me to say that product A is better than product B. Many reasons for that. One of them is that things are changing very, very quickly in the database world. They were sort of stagnated for 10 years, and they have very recently ramped up. And that's part of the exciting thing about database research, and I hope to convince you that it's a very interesting field to work on and to pay attention to. So for the talk, I'll just start by a very brief overview on the history of database research. And I'll try to make the point that, you know, what goes around comes around, and what we are passing through today in databases is sort of similar to what has happened many, many years ago. And perhaps there are some lessons to learn from there. Then I'll discuss a bit about hardware. The reasons for that is our group works very much closely to computer architecture, so we pay a lot of attention to hardware. So it's good to have an idea of what are the limitations, how is hardware evolving. So that will be quite a bit of the talk. Then I'll talk about some topics in modern databases. Quickly skimming through several topics. I don't really have time to go in detail. I'll just give you a flavor of different things that are happening in several places. So let's get started. So about history. So if you go back to the early 1970s, and I don't know that, these people tell me that, what was happening is that there was a complete overabundance of database offerings. So there was, you know, basically every database from every vendor was different, was incompatible, had strong points, had weak points. They were exposing far too many implementation details. So it means that developers liked it because it was very quick and easy to get started. The problem is, it was actually a pain to compare products. It was just very difficult. And then Seth Godin came along, and he made a quite literary revolution, created a whole multi-billion dollar industry by proposing a relational model. And with that came along a language, SQL, structured query language. And what this made is that the implementation differences between these databases became irrelevant. It didn't matter who was actually implementing it, because the functionality they offered was more or less assigned. And when it's assigned, you can start comparing things. And when you can compare, you can make benchmarks, and you can do rankings, and then the whole industry evolves from that. The uniformity brought some direct competition, and in the end, you ended up having three players on the database market. So that was, you know, could be Sybase, Oracle, DB2. Nowadays, I think you would say it's Microsoft, SQL Server, Oracle, and DB2. What you see today is that there has been a complete explosion in database offerings. It's one of the areas with more startups going on. All of them have different interfaces, and there's no uniformity. You might know some of these ones. You might not know, be familiar with some other ones. I will give a few examples on what some of them are doing and how some of these databases came about from research results. So, the point that I want to make here is that in today's world, one size does not fit all. So for a long time, or for some years, people were reasonably happy with having one large database instance that they were managing, and that was coping with pretty much every use case. If it didn't cope so well, that's left. There's advantages in having a single one. Today, that's no longer the case. The requirements are sufficiently different, and databases are propagating a bit everywhere, and it's very, very hard to have a single database system that can encompass all the use cases. And we'll get back to this later on. So let's talk about hardware and what's happening there and what barriers we are facing. Now, the first point, you might have seen similar talks and similar results in other contexts. And the first point I want to talk about is, you know, getting data to the CPU. It's a very simple task, right? You have a CPU that is writing its registers to do some operations. That's how an instruction runs. Now, these are results from 2004, from a famous paper by David Patterson, but the same trend still holds, by and large. If you look at the CPU, its bandwidth is growing annually at a certain rate. You know, with your value there, from the paper, 1.5. And its latency is being reduced by a certain rate. If you look at memory, there's a different rate. And what's happening is that CPUs are getting, their bandwidth is getting higher and the latency is getting smaller at a faster rate than what's happening with memory. Now, this actually matters a lot, and this is defining pretty much everything that's been happening at the high-end trend and, by consequence, in database systems. Because it means memory is getting further away from the CPU. It's harder, it's slower to read data from memory to the CPU than it was before. It's faster in absolute terms, it's slower in relative terms, because the CPU is getting faster and it just spends more time waiting for data to come in before it can actually do anything. Now, that's a problem, and there are solutions to it. In the short and medium term, in the short term might not be so much of a problem, in the medium term there are some solutions. Like, you know, one has to work on cache locality, so whenever you bring a piece of data to the processor cache, you have to make absolute maximum use of it. You cannot bring anything you don't need, because if you're bringing stuff you don't need, you're just wasting time, because then you eventually have to go and get something you actually need. There's hardware solutions, so people are talking about, you know, putting memory quite physically on top of the CPU and having some interconnectivity to just be able to gain some speed there. So it is a trend. It's a trend that's probably here to stay for a while, and it's going to define how many of the database systems are being designed. The second trend I want to talk about is about getting the right data to the right CPU. So the other thing that's been happening, you know, in a sense, you know, the large scaling is over. We're going to keep the Moore's Law going, we're just going to multi-core architectures, eventually many-core architectures. And, you know, this is a typical CPU 3 years old, but the same thing holds to that. You have two sockets, basically two CPUs. Each one of them has four cores. They have some 8 megabytes of the cache. They have some, you know, some connection called TPI in the case of Intel different CPUs. And then you have some connection to the I/O, and then you have memory, DDR3. And if you notice, this memory is attached to this CPU, and this memory is attached to that CPU. And this is a single machine, right? Now, this is no longer a single CPU. It's two CPUs with four socket each. The resulting architecture is called NUMA, non-uniform memory architecture. Because if this core is related from here, it's going to get at a different place with the same core it's written from there, because it has to go to the other CPU. Now, it seems that this might not matter so much because, you know, it's hardware, it's just a bit fast. It actually does matter, because if you come up with, you know, a simple benchmark, and this is a machine we have on the lab that has 8 CPUs, 10 cores each, so quite a big machine, even by today's standards. And you have some computation you're doing, and the details don't matter so much. But the point is, you have a bunch of threads doing something together and another bunch of threads doing something together, and you have several sysgroups. Depending on how you locate these threads in different cores, in different CPUs, you will get very different results. So for instance, if you spread them, so if you have basically one thread in each CPU doing stuff and you have to communicate across CPUs, you get a certain throughput, and it's very good. If you group them in an optimal way, if you experiment with things and how you allocate threads to cores and you spend quite some time doing that, you'll get a much higher throughput, and notice, you know, 3x maybe, even a bit more. So it matters, because it means you're playing for a very expensive machine, and if you do the right thing, you get 3x the performance. If you don't do, you may get 2. The other interesting result is what happens if you don't worry about it, and you let the operating system do it. So there's quite a lot of work in scheduling at the operating system level. The problem is the operating system will never have enough information to make the right decision. So what it is that it doesn't get ideal throughput, but the worst thing is that it varies quite a lot. And it's just an example. You have to run this experiment over and over again, and you're sort of getting different results. So this is a worrying trend, because it means if you're programming it in a naive way, you'll get not only not the top performance, but you also get unpredictable performance. And predictable is usually the worst thing you can do in terms of performance, the thing you can get. Now, what's the solution here? It's not obvious. There's this idea of trying to do, you know, you have to come up with the right abstraction so that people who are programming this system don't have to worry about every single detail. One is sort of forming islands of computation. For instance, you know, you always treat the socket as a whole entity and you try not to go across CPUs all the time. It basically means we need smarter software. So you will see that this is something that's having an effect on today's database. We are actually working on Oracle on this issue. They are funding us to try and solve it. Another trend I want to talk is about storage. So the first piece of this is good news. It's about the capacity of hard disk drives. So it's growing, keeps on growing. So, you know, you go back to 1991, and you go, 2019. There's a bunch of technologies in today's systems, and there's a bunch of technologies that are being implemented today, and there's a bunch of technologies being designed. And there's a good amount of confidence in the community that this is not a problem. We'll be able to pack more data in the same disk. We'll just be able to compress it more, not compress it, but actually condense it. There's physical effects there. There's different ways to record data. So this is good news. So disks will stay the same size, and they'll, be 1 terabyte, 2 terabytes, 3 terabytes, 4 terabytes. They'll keep on growing. And that's a very good thing. We need that. The bad news is that somehow similar to memory, the latency to access that data and the bandwidth with which we can access it is not increasing fast enough. So you see the same trend. So you see the CPU having the same annual and bandwidth improvement as before from every new generation. But you see that the hard disks are not coping in nearly the same way, again. So it means that disks are becoming further away from CPU. CPUs are becoming faster, disks are becoming also bigger and faster, but not bigger and faster fast enough. The worst thing is that these numbers are about sequential accuracy. If you go to random bandwidth, it's even worse. Just think about it. The CPU, you have this spindle, these things rotating, and you have like 4 or 5 processors trying to figure out where the thing is at this point in time and doing approximation, error correction. It's very complex. If you have random bandwidth coming in, random requests coming in, and you have, in the same area, you're putting in more data, it's just very hard to make it go fast. So, and if you look at, the RPMs, the number of rotations of a disk, if you think about the numbers you have today and you had 10 years ago, they are more or less the same. They haven't actually increased. And they will not increase. It's just too expensive. It's just not economical to do that. So again, that's obviously had an impact on database systems, because database systems usually store data in disk, so something has to happen there. You could say, well, the solution is to use Flash, right? Flash solves most of these problems. Well, it does solve part of the problems, and Flash is not even the only technology that we can use. Before I move on, Jim Gray already sort of famously said 2006, tape is dead, disk is tape, Flash is disk, and RAM locality is king. And I think that's definitely the trend we have to pay attention to. So tape is definitely for something you probably don't really need. Disk is effectively the new type, Flash is effectively the disk, and all your code has to be built thinking about RAM locality, cache locality. We have a chance to talk with the big database vendors, we have a chance to talk with the big cloud vendors, and this is what they are doing. They are already treating the storage this way. But again, about Flash. Flash is not the only technology, there's also phase change memory. There are prototypes out there, probably coming to market already next year. What's interesting about TCM, and this is the number for TCM today, the prototype is what is already effectively happening even if it's not released in the market, is that, it has a pretty good read bandwidth, it has a pretty good write bandwidth, which, Flash also has even better. The point is, the read latency is smaller, and the write latency is smaller, and has the potential to be much smaller than Flash. The endurance is also an important factor. The endurance in Flash is actually going down with time. And the reason is that they are trying, when you buy a 256 gigabyte flash drive, you're probably getting like a 500 gigabyte flash drive, and the rest is just Mr. Endurance. So because if you tend to write in the same spot, you will burn down that area and you're using data. So there's the controller and the drivers that try to spread how you write data to avoid this effect. With TCM, this is not so much of a problem. The other advantage is the write latency being much better. When you have to write in Flash, you can't write a small bit there, you have to write a sort of a large chunk. With TCM, it doesn't happen. TCM is more similar to DRAM. So you can actually read just bite-sized data. So that by itself means it's a much more interesting technology to look at, because it means, again, when you need to read data from the storage, you can just read the data you need. That one goes to the memory, and just the one you need also goes to CPU. And because of this trend I was discussing, it's important to minimize how much data you're bringing in all along. Now, another way to look at this, and these are slides by Steven Swanson from UCSD. He runs the non-volatile memory labs at UCSD. They do very cool work. And here I'm just plotting how things improve. X-axis is latency improvements, and Y-axis is bandwidth improvements. So we saw this one, and that's a bit from 2006. If you pick up a PCI flash card from 2007, you're just right about there. So you have, you know, 100 times better latency than a disk, and let's say 100 times better bandwidth than a disk. If you move on, and you pick up one of the early PCM prototypes, you're just right about there. So you have more bandwidth, you have slightly less latency compared to the flash. If you pick up one of the new flash cards, that's a Fusion I.O., we have several of them in the labs. You're just right about there. So 1,000 times the bandwidth of the disk of 2006 and about 100 times the latency. The interesting point starts being on this line. What's going to happen with the PCM in 2013? Well, there's quite a great deal of confidence that these results are correct. So you're going to be almost one order of magnitude above in both axes compared to a flash card from 2007. So that's very interesting. And then there's even other types of DDR, the non-volatile memory. So this is a bit of speculation, but there's a great deal of confidence that it will be achieved. So you'll get, again, you know, almost 10,000 times better latency and bandwidth than a disk. Now, this matters a lot, because it means if we move away from disk to flash, then to PCM, then to something else, and people are confident that this will be a steady progression, you're getting absolutely massive improvement, and the storage stops being a bottleneck. And if the storage stops being a bottleneck, there will be other parts that will show up as a bigger bottleneck. And the point is, if you do, I mean, these are not, I'm not plotting the exact numbers, and these are just approximations, but it means that from 2006 to 2016, you get about 2.4x improvement per year. So this is more than the CPU's improvement. So actually, the storage can be keeping up and, you know, almost coming up to get closer to the CPU, and that's a very good thing. Now, Steven also went a bit further and actually studied what is the impact. Now that you have really fast storage, what happened? Well, what happened is that other things became a problem, and actually the problem becomes a software. So when you have a disk, and if you think about the software contribution to the latency, it's almost nothing, right? Because the disk is so slow that when you're reading any data from disk, it doesn't matter how slow your software is, you can put lots of logic in, it doesn't matter. The disk is just orders of magnitude slower. When you start moving along with a bunch of technologies coming along, and you look at battery-backed DRAM, for instance, which is non-volatile because it has a battery. You know, the software also further contributes a great deal to latency, and if you go to other, you know, forms of non-volatile memories, it contributes even a great deal more. And it's not just that software becomes a problem. It's also not just the latency is a problem, it's also the energy. Because again, a disk spins for quite some time, and because it takes time, it consumes energy. And if you plot the same thing in terms of energy consumption, you also start to see that software starts to dominate in terms of energy. So, about these hardware trends, so what I want you to remember from this section. First, that memory is getting further away from the CPU. So it's becoming more and more expensive to read data from memory to the CPU. And it's a trend that's here a bit to slide. That, you know, some CPUs, some cores that actually do the work are very close to each other. Others are getting very far away. And that's fine in a sense, but the software is just not prepared for that. It's not obvious even how to prepare it for that. The other point is that disks, traditional disks, are becoming very far from the CPUs, so to the point that they are just not interesting anymore to use for anything that needs high performance. And flash and CCM are better, definitely. And future types of non-volatile memories will be even better. But the problem here again is that our software is not prepared for that. Because if you, you know, if you're doing POSIX, doing an FOPEN over something that's actually not a disk, like a non-volatile memory, you're spending 90% of your time in the POSIX call, in the POSIX interface. And that's not a good thing. That's not a, that's obviously not what you want, because then you lose the benefit. And the point is, you know, the era of, you know, free lunch, software release speedups is definitely over. And we see that in many ways. And people tend to focus a lot in the multicore, how we program multicore. Then the point that I want to bring up here is not just the multicore, how to program it, it's a whole lot of problems, not just that one. So now we go in the sense to the second part of the talk is about databases. So what have been people doing in databases and some of the techniques that may alleviate some of these problems. Now the second part is divided in a few different areas. I'll talk a little bit about techniques for scaling up databases. I'll talk a little bit about techniques for scaling up means, you know, within a single node, how do you make the thing run faster? That's essentially what it is. Scaling out is how do you make it run in more machines, because at some point you just have too much data and you need to spread it around. Some very brief words about scientific databases. I think that's relevant for certain. Some words about how easy databases are to use and how easy they are to maintain. Now, from now on, you know, almost every other slide is a different technique. Apologies for that, but that's the way I can make sense of what's going on. And at least I hope that from each of these topics you'll, you know, sort of find an area that you're interested in, and then you can just ask me and I can give you specific pointers on it. So let's talk about how to scale up the database engine, how to make it actually take advantage of the hardware. The first thing I want to talk about is about traditional transaction execution. So a lot of what our group does at ETFL is profiling, is looking at what's happening in the database engine and where the bottlenecks are. A very simple exercise is the following. Suppose you have a transaction. So this is called from a benchmark called TPCC. It's called a payment transaction. Think about, you know, shop and warehouses and you're doing orders and the like. And in the x-axis you have time. And in the y-axis you have record. Each line represents a record and the address number from 0 to 20. And every time, you know, there's a point here, it means that a given thread accesses this line, that's it. And I put a quarter per thread. So that's why you see all these quarters, there's a certain number of threads, and I put a quarter per thread. So what's the pattern here? There's absolutely no pattern, right? And that's the point. These are how databases work today, right? It's completely unpredictable access patterns. And when you have access patterns, it means you have, you know, a very big source of contention. It's just very hard to schedule anything, to divide work, etc., etc. Now, what can you do? And I don't want to go through many of the details. You can pick up a big transaction and split it into small pieces. And each small piece is responsible for a part of the data. And you allocate a part of the data to a particular thread. So you organize the work, basically. You split the transaction into pieces automatically. And then you make sure that the thread is only responsible for accessing this part of the data. You make it sort of a data-oriented transaction execution. Now you have to come up with sort of a graph that represents a transaction. You have to put some kind of points and some other details that one could think make things a little bit slower. But the takeaway point is the following, is that this is the pattern you get, right? All of a sudden, you know, this record, this part of the database is literally handled by a single thread, and this part by another thread, etc., etc. And this is something that's totally oblivious to whoever is using the database. You don't need to know about it, you just write your SQL, it all exists. Internally, the database engine does this sort of partitioning and reorganizing and the transaction. What you have is, you know, an access pattern that actually makes sense to the human eye, that's predictable, and then all of a sudden you can do a bunch of optimizations. Because, you know, databases work a lot, the traditional ones, you know, you have to lock data, make sure it doesn't get corrupted, if this guy is accessing and this other guy wants to access, this one holds the lock. When you have this sort of organization, you don't need much of the locking anymore. If you don't need locking, you're much faster. Because logging is one of these parts of the database system that particularly when you have big machines, the log holder is jumping around cores and jumping around CPUs and they sometimes going to memory. And we all know this is not a good thing, this is slow. And all sorts of optimizations can become possible. So that's one example of a technique that has been proposed and definitely will eventually make it into a product, I'm pretty sure. And the result, the practical result, data-oriented reactive execution is actually called DORES. And you compare with TM1, that's the telecommunications benchmark. You know, the important part is the blue part. The blue part is the useful word. And if you look in the baseline, the traditional system, you're basically spending all your time in log managers and logging records and figuring out things around. And if you go this way, you spend much, you know, close to 80% of your time doing actual useful work, actually doing transactions, basically. Similar thing with BTC, another transaction called order status from the BTC benchmark. There's an improvement there as well. You know, I went through this point. And this is how it actually runs in the Niagara BTC machine. So this is a result that's a little bit old, but it is a slightly older machine. Similar results holding you in your machine. At some point, you get almost 2x performance. If you saturate the machine, you get flat performance. So it's a really ideal architecture because you can run at 100% CPU utilization. You don't have these sudden drops. You don't have unpredictable behavior. Everything becomes much easier to use. So I don't want to say that this particular technique is the way to go or this system is the way to go. It's more about the technique, the underlying technique to solve these sorts of problems. That's important. Now, another point I want to talk about, I'm switching to a different one here, is about rows and columns. You might have thought about row stores, you might have heard about column stores. So why are people paying so much attention to this and what is it and why does it matter? Well, this one is actually pretty simple. And if you go back to the results about CPU and memory accesses becoming further away, it follows almost immediately. Suppose you have a table, has four columns, in this example. How do you represent in memory? Well, you have to represent in a linear representation. You can just put, you know, the first row here, second row here, the third row, etc., etc., and you keep on going. And that's what the traditional databases do in memory. Now, suppose you want to sum all the values in column one. You actually do that, and you can actually write a C program. You don't need a database to do that. What happens is that 95% of your time is waiting for data to come into the CPU. So when you actually run the program, it's saying 100% CPU utilization. But then you actually go into the details, and of course this changes, and you get the new Sandy Bridge, which has a better, you know, prefetcher, and the numbers are a bit better. But the CPU is effectively 95% unused to do a very, very, very simple sum of a column, right? It looks like it's easy, but it's not. It's actually just waiting for the data to come in. Now, in this example, the logical thing you can do is what we call the column store. So instead of putting one row after a row, you put all the columns next to each other. And you know that the first position on that column is one, column one, second position is column two, etc., etc. And now if you want to sum the values on column one, you just have to go through those records. And because that comes in as a cache line, comes into your CPU cache, which takes some time, but as soon as it comes in, you're basically using all the data you got. And often if you do that, you get 100% CPU utilization. And that's, you know, that's the magic of column stores. People try systems like MonaDB or Vertica, and they are just astonished at the performance they get compared to, you know, Oracle for that type of queries. That's the reason, because it makes actual use of your CPU. So it goes back to that point. The cache locality is absolute key here. Now, most relational database systems remain row stores. IBM DB2, Oracle, SQL Server, you name all these, are row stores. That's the way they were built. There's good reasons, there's very good properties with row stores. So if you have a query that touches many values in a single row, you might as well get the whole row, right? If you're doing aggregation, sort of analytics queries, you want to get average of something or sum something, and that touches many values in a single column, then you want to use a column store. And again, vector-wise people, the spin-off from CWI group in Amsterdam, are probably the ones who were initially behind the whole concept. Vertica is a company of an axon breaker. They have a product which is just about that. MonetDB is also from CWI, working on that. It's not ideal for every single case, but that's the reason why it matters and why this, why column stores are important if you're doing, you know, aggregation, sort of business intelligence queries as they are called. There's another thing with it, is that, you know, when you have data that's together, sitting together, you can compress it much better. It just compresses better because it's similar data, right? You can do deltas, you can do many, many easy things. And because very often the CPU is not really busy all the time, you can actually compress data and not lose any performance whatsoever, because the data compression is happening in the time that the CPU would otherwise be idle. So compression really helps if you have smart compression algorithms. So it's a case where you can compress data and get higher performance even because you're just reading less data in. There's also, you know, quite a bit of research into hybrid systems. So sometimes you want queries to behave as a column store, sometimes you want to behave as a row store, you want to switch over on the fly. If you start Googling for these things, you'll have, you know, it's a very active area of research that's definitely making into products already today. And of course, there's all sorts of query optimization issues. You know, how do you choose which is the ideal layout for answering a particular query? It's not trivial at all. So it's a, you know, it's a very active area. Now, another area that I find quite interesting is about query compilation. So just a little bit of background. So how do database systems actually work? Well, you give a SQL query. There's the query optimization step. And the result of the query optimization step is what's called the query plan tree. Something like this. This is a very simple example. In this case, you have a table, and the data flows, you know, bottom up. You're reading data from this table. You're doing some filtering. So you know, select something from table A where x greater than 10. Well, that's this x greater than 10 gets some here. Then you're doing some join with data being read from another table. You're doing another filtering step, and then you're doing a project. A project, you are just choosing some columns. So you don't select star, you select something, comma, center from in the query. The way the database system works internally, the database engine, there's a query execution engine that, you know, you have code for these operators and for these operators, and there's all this logic where you build a tree, which, you know, there's many implementations of filters. And of joins, particular joins, there's many, and they bring in statistics which joins to use, etc. But the code is fairly isolated. You can actually pick up a database system, an open source line, you can get Postgres or MySQL code, and you see the code for the filter operator, for the join operator, etc. These are fairly isolated systems. So, one way to make it faster, because that's, you know, usually the goal, almost always, is that you, instead of creating sort of this tree in memory, where you have an actual tree in memory and this is the parent node and the data goes from here to here, is that actually you do a bit like the compilers do. You generate machine code for a query. So you write an SQL query, you submit it, and there's an actual compilation step that picks up the code from the machine, from the database, and actually recompiles for that specific query. Now, this actually gives an enormous performance boost because first, there's code for that query, which the compiler will figure out optimizations that it will be very hard to put in otherwise. You know, the compiler can pass its data in the right way between operators so that things flow really, really nicely. You never have to shift around data and other things. The actual code that needs to run is less, because you need to run this code for this query. So there's better instruction locality. And think about it, instructions in a computer, because of the von Neumann architecture, are data, right? They are in memory. So if you need to read in data of the program, the instructions, it's also slow. So if you have less of those, it's also better. It means you have shorter code paths, and it means that the system can do, you know, sort of all kinds of optimization tricks there. And compiler technology has evolved quite a bit, that, you know, it's nearly impossible to compete with a compiler in writing hand code to some better. But this is very attractive, and it's actually making it into database products, I guess, very soon, because there's IBM prototypes doing just this. This was worked on in Munich. Now, there are people who take this a step further, just to give you the idea of the specialization that's happening. which is hardware query compilation. So this goes one step further. You pick up a query and comes up with a hardware service to answer that query. It sounds almost ridiculous, but in some cases it makes a lot of sense. So our colleagues at PhDRIC are doing that with FPGAs. FPGAs have low latency, high throughput, and they also consume very little power. So for a particular query, there are some sort of building blocks that are, you know, already stored in FPGA, and for a particular instance of a query, you just have to, you know, hardwire a few things, and there you have a circuit that answers the query. Now, this has been very interesting for the financial market because they want absolutely lowest latency possible, and their workloads don't change very much. Now, this is an interesting area of research, quite active. Historically, it has been very difficult. Similar things have been tried before. There have been database machines, I mean, hardware designed to do database-specific acceleration in the past. Those companies never really were successful. So, and the reason is that workload changes are costly. And by the time, you know, you're finishing building your hardware, there's some commodity piece of hardware, your next iPhone is just much faster, so it doesn't matter. You spend 1 year doing the hardware, and then the normal evolution actually keeps up with you. The thing is that with FPGAs, it's a much faster cycle, so it starts to be interesting. And there's all kinds of ideas on how to shorten this time. And it's actually quite impressive when you see the first time, like a demo of a query over XML data, which you may ask, if you have XML, why are you trying to make it faster? But people do have it. And it was an XFAT query, and you click, an FPGA gets burned, and the query gets executed. And then the first time, of course, a bit slower, and then it's just incredibly fast. So it's sort of ideas that are going on to make performance and machine scale with acceleration. Now, some words about SSDs and databases. This is something almost everyone we talk to is considering. Those who have two disks laying around, how do you actually take advantage of solid state to improve database performance? Well, a very simple example, and that's going also to make this research result going to make it into products very soon, is a case where you have a data warehouse where you're doing all kinds of analytic queries, but you have some updates happening all the time. And if you have updates happening all the time and you have these scans to answer queries, you know, they don't go very well with each other. So if, you know, if you're doing a query, you get some normalized and execution time. If you're doing the query and some updates are happening at the same time, you're just much slower. This is what will happen if you do the query and then you do the update. Better, but not right. What you want is this. You want the updates not to matter for the query. The thing is that these are actually results. You can actually get this. And the point is, by carefully balancing where you put SSDs, that sort of a tiered storage, so that the blades go into SSD because it has low latency, right for write. And there's a background process in the background just merging them to the data warehouse. You can get this sort of effect. So there is no definite solution where you should place SSDs in the database system. Should they be your only storage system? Or should they be sort of an accelerator, like in this example? It seems like the idea of using SSDs as an accelerator makes quite a bit of sense. It does mean you need database-specific algorithms for it. If you're just going to replace your disk SSDs, you get a better performance. It's wonderful. Doesn't mean you get the best performance even, because the databases are designed to work on this. It's designed to work on SSDs. So in the database research, I would say that by far people are looking at strategically placing SSDs in some areas to accelerate some operations, not the whole lot. Now, some words about new architecture. So I've been mentioning how to scale up databases. There's something else that's happening in the background and we'll have to pay attention to. So as Dave Patterson mentioned, most server innovations are coming from the mobile service device world. iPhones and the like, that's the one selling most CPUs nowadays. So low power chips will become commonplace in data centers. I think that's taken basically as a fact now. The question is, how do we program this? So this is, you know, this is an ARM slide. The Cortex, it's an architecture called Big Little. It meets an ARM Cortex A7, so something that is coming out, might be a, you know, low-end smartphone processor, with a Cortex A15. The process that's out, that's kind of a high-end. I think some of the fancy smartphones already have an A15. What they do is that they actually pick up these two processors, and they merge them together into one. into a single process. And in hardware, when you're doing whatever your operations are doing, if you don't need that much performance, they don't take you much power, and you're running on the A16. And when you need higher performance, the hardware will dynamically switch to the A16. It won't do anything, but the hardware will switch for you. And then the A15, consumes more power, but also delivers much better performance. Now, this is great technology because it sort of, you get this power proportional computing. So if you're doing something that doesn't take that much power, it won't consume much power. And if you're doing something that's compute intensive, you'll consume more power. This is very attractive architecture. The problem is how to program these things. No one has any idea, because sure, the hardware changes for you, but you need to be aware of certain things to get higher performance. So again, people in the database community are actively looking at this thing to see what can be done there and how to take advantage of it. It's one for which there are no results, but it's an important one. Now, let me talk about scaling out. So I'll talk about scaling up databases. Let me talk about scaling out to multiple nodes. Now, just a parenthesis. Just wanted to talk about the CAP theorem, because every time you read about blobs and NoSQL and the like, people are talking about this CAP theorem. So CAP theorem is the theorem in distributed systems that says that given the three properties, consistency, availability, and partitioning, you cannot have the three of them holding at the same time. You can only have two of them. So you can have a system that's consistent and highly available, but if you have that, it will not tolerate partitioning. Partitioning is like when you have some nodes, you have 10 nodes, two nodes go offline. That's a partition. And you can have a system that's that supports consistency and partitioning, but then it's not highly available. Some requests that you will make to the system will not be answered immediately. You'll have to wait, I guess, until the partition comes back. And you can have a system that's highly available and supports partitioning, tolerates partition, but then you lose consistency. And NoSQL crowd will immediately say, well, because of the CAP theorem, we choose availability and partitioning. And that's kind of I wouldn't say the marketing, but that's a bit what it describes as. Now, what I want to say that, because it confuses very many people, is that it's not so simple. So it's a theorem that has certain assumptions, right? Not a lot of physics, even those have assumptions, right? But it depends how you define the terms. And the theorem is very well defined, the terms, but one can play with the definition. So when you say availability, you mean uptime, latency, or performance. And when you mean consistency, you mean data freshness. You want to make sure that when you write something and you read back immediately after, is it the same or you tolerate some time there? Or integrity of data or isolation. When you make two concurrent requests, do they see intermediate results of the other request or not? When you talk about partitioning, are you talking about one node going offline or a minority of nodes? And when you play with these definitions, you're placed somewhere in this triangle, right? And every single system will aim at a different position here. So it's not what I'm trying to say is that you don't need to give away consistency to have availability and partitioning. You may need to give a little bit of consistency to have more availability. It's a gray area, not absolute terms. And the point is, when you hear about the CAP theorem, this is not a guide, it's not a rule, right? It's not like you have to choose two or three. Well, it depends what the two mean exactly. The other principle I want to make before I talk about scale out is about eventual consistency. Some database systems guarantee eventually consistency. That doesn't mean anything. That's a contradiction in terms. You can't guarantee something will be eventually consistent because then it will be inconsistent and it will be consistent again. It doesn't really mean much. The other point, a disclaimer, you're hearing this from a database person who has a certain background, right? So it may not be the typical NoSQL crowd. They might disagree with it. I'm sure they will. The other point, and this we get from very experienced people who have worked also in NoSQL, is that eventually consistency is often not enough. And I think a good demonstration of that is that you end up having these systems having more and more nodes that you can tune to strengthen the consistency in there. Because there's always a use case where you actually need things to be consistent. You have user accounts and changing passwords and simple things, and then things get complicated. The third point I want to make, and this is well known, if you have a system that's weakly consistent, it's very hard to make it consistent, to strengthen it. Because going to database research, you know, these, you have to build it from the ground up, and you have locks and latches and logs and storage, and all these things are very intertwined. So either do it from the beginning, or it's very hard to, you know, pick up a system and try to strengthen it by doing some hacks on the application side or on the database side. I think Mehul put it nicely, eventually consistency is eventually not enough. And I think there's a, you know, within the database, the traditional database researchers, that's pretty much the take. And the idea is that if you need to do that, the way you should do it is that you start from a consistent core, that is a database, and you relax it. So there are use cases where you don't need consistency, but that's how you should do it, not the other way around. Not start weakly consistent and then figuring out how to make it consistent. So having said that, let me talk about NoSQL. I don't have that much to say, actually. It simplifies the programming model. It relaxes constraints. That's a very good thing. It has different design points from classical database systems. So if you go to the CAP theorem, database systems will be worried about consistency, availability, or depending on the flavor. You don't just have different design models. So the relational model is done in such a way that encourages joins, which are expensive at scale. So they opt to dropping or relaxing either atomicity or consistency or availability or all of them or part of them. And the support for schemas is limited, but it's quite flexible. Now, the point is, again, individual design choices lead to very different products. So you cannot put the NoSQL crowd in one camp. It depends on each specific system and what it was designed for. So it's actually ideal for some workloads and some configurations, just not for all of them in a way. And the low entry barrier is appealing, and that's a very important point. Today we still have many heterogeneous and compatible offerings. That's perhaps the thing that's keeping some people away from NoSQL, but it's definitely very easy to get started. Now, there's NoSQL and there's NewSQL. So what is NewSQL? NewSQL is sort of the, let's put it, the traditional database community having a take on this problem. And what they try to do is, same as looks a lot like a traditional database, ACID compliant, but they try to make it highly scalable. How do you make that? Well, you have to partition data. If you partition data, you can scale as much as you want. It's easy, right? But if you partition data, it means you can simplify your code path. Your database engine becomes much simpler. If you have certain partitions that never overlap, you don't need to lock when you're reading data from one or the other, because you know they never overlap. And if you do these things and you design systems from the ground up, and VaultDB is a very good example of that, the performance just, it's absolutely extraordinary. Problem is, partitioning data in the first place is difficult. If you have queues, if you have data partitions that change all the time, almost impossible to cope with it. So there's some research there on how to make better partitioning techniques. You do have to do two-phase commits to get consistent queues over two parties. That has a big overhead. There's some research on trying to minimize that. But there's other scaling out ideas. You know, there's no one solution. You can give up determinism to get scalability. So, you know, when you have a database system, you assume there's no deterministic. These are threads running, you don't know when they are starting to run or which request comes next. Therefore, you have to do all these lockings and protections to make sure things are consistent. You can have a database system that's designed from the ground up to, you know, come up with a deterministic code path. So these are the sequence of steps you're going to do. And if you do that, you can achieve great scalability. You know, you have to give up the freedom for a transaction to abort in a non-deterministic way. You have to give up the ability to reorder requests on the fly. You reorder them once and it's paid for everyone. And what you get, again, scalability and the traditional ACID compliance, the transactional support of the database. And Calvin is a prototype from that. And actually, it's impressive because they were running it on Amazon. Linear scalability, up to 100 machines. And that's transaction, 500,000 transactions per second. That's nearly a world record. An equivalent Oracle machine to do that costs $30 million. This one costs, I think, $100 in Amazon. So it just tells you that when you have different designs, different ideas, you can do things in different ways. And then there's MapReduce. Not that much to say that. I think the interesting thing from a database perspective because the MapReduce crowd, a bit like the NoSQL crowd, is implementing indexes, views, query optimization. So these are very database technologies. I think it's a good thing because it says that declarative interfaces, you know, the traditional SQL style approach, does help productivity of programmers as much as people often don't like it. So it does help. And there's all these, you know, ideas to combine MapReduce with RDBMSs. Habati from the old group also has a startup called Habap doing sort of similar things. But there's not that much, you know, research results that are very exciting that I can tell you about. A word on scientific databases. just wanted to mention this because one particular kind of scientific database, because this is getting a lot of attention in the research community, and I think CERN should be a definite part of this effort. So, look at relational databases. They lack support for arrays. They are about tables, right? Sets. But alternative databases are common. In many scientific applications, astronomy perhaps, you know, the first example, there are many others. It turns out that the financial services crowd also uses arrays quite a bit, and because they use, you know, things get done and companies start working on it. So, the basic idea is that when you have a, you know, two-dimensional array, or two-dimensional matrix, you know, you have two dimensions, you see sort of relational database, sort of like this, right? X, Y, or something or I, J, and these are the dimensions. When you start in an array database that has a particular built-in data model for array, you start it like this, so it takes less space overall, and it's much easier to do neighborhood queries. Here, they are very hard to do, and there's all kinds of conditions, and here, it just becomes much more natural. So if you store these chunks of an array on disk and you read it in, you'll get all the data together. It belongs together, it's together. Now, besides the data model that I think makes a lot of sense for some scientific applications, I don't know if it makes sense for you, but it makes sense for many. The thing that I find interesting is that array databases, unlike the traditional HPC approach, have the following three properties. First, they integrate storage and computation. So the HPC world, you typically have the storage on one side, the compute on the other side, and then a pipe in between. Quite frankly, I find that this doesn't make that much sense, right? And particularly with the hardware trends, it even makes less sense. These ones bring them together. The systems that are storing data are also doing the computation, which brings all kinds of optimization and filtering that you can do. The other is that it has a declarative language. So there's no standard there. There's some proposals with limitations, but there is a declarative language where you say how you want your results, you don't say how you're going to compute those results. You let the system do that for you. And the way to do it is with query optimization. So I find these three properties very important. Not that query optimization is a solved problem, not by any means. But I think it's, you know, no matter how good are your programmers, when you go to very complex modern hardware with all kinds of conditions, it's going to get very harder and much harder to write optimized code for it. It's going to get nearly impossible. You have machines with, you know, you have a CPU with six cores, multi-cores, and many core PCIe cards attached to it, perhaps an FPGA, a GPU on the side. It's just very, very hard to program this thing as one entity. So, some words just to wrap up on usability and maintenance. So, there's also quite a bit of research on auto-tuning. And the typical database tuning decisions are, you know, what indexes should I create, which part of data should I use this index, when should I create it. And traditionally, databases do it offline. You go in and you create index, and no one can actually be doing anything while you're doing that, create index thing. More recently, there's been work on online indexing techniques, and there's other techniques called cracking. I'll just give an example of what cracking is, just because it's very simple and easy to understand what's happening. So suppose you have a query, like select star for R where A is between 10 and 14, and you have a column. So when you run this query, and you don't have an index, one way to do a type of index is that as you are scanning the column in memory, you're cracking it into three pieces. So you're creating one piece where A is less than or equal to 10, so it doesn't hold this condition, where A is between 10 and 14, and where A is greater than 10. So you're basically scanning this array sequentially, and you're just swapping the attributes, sort of like a Pixar step, that you need. And your result in memory is this one. When a second query comes in, if the query asks, you know, get me between 11 and 13, you just need to read this part here. because, you know, 10 and 14 encompasses between 11 and 14. So that's the overall idea. Very simple concept. It works really well in practice. And you just create a database, no indexes, let users run some queries. After a while, your database has the ideal index for that workload. And if the developers come up with a totally different workload and the skill, the database adapts to it and eventually creates the ideal index with cracked columns for it. So it means that you can always read the data you need. There's lots of the tricks that have been done. There's almost one of the final topics about in situ query processing. So that's also something that the community is working on, and our group is also working on it. And the idea there is to make databases a bit easier to use. You know, databases have their own file format. You know, Oracle has their own page structure on disk, and MySQL has another, and DB2 has another. So why don't we drop that? Why don't we just focus on the query engine and let the database query data where it is in its own file format? It turns out you can actually do that, and it's actually not even very difficult. It means that when you need to do queries over the data, it's a bit like Hadoop, right? You don't have to do any data loading. No, data loading, you don't have to replicate type. You don't have any vendor locking. Your data is only on Oracle or DB2. This doesn't happen. You don't have also any explicit indexing, and you can combine this with the previous technique. And, you know, suppose you have a sequence of queries. You have a part that it takes to load data. And you have a system that actually goes and queries it on disk directly and just creates these auxiliary structures to know where data is. Because you don't actually have the data loading, you know, the first queries can be a bit slower, but they get incrementally faster. So that's something that was sort of a surprising result, that you take away a specific database file format and things get faster. But they do, and this work that has been gaining quite a bit of attention because of this property. Imagine something that queries over your root files without having to load them into something else. Yeah. So, just a final word on cloud computing, just because I think it's really important. I think you should definitely pay attention to what's happening on the cloud, and not because I'm saying you eventually migrate your data there, I don't know if you will or not, but the people operating the cloud infrastructures are the people defining what hardware looks like. I mean, Amazon buys the entire world's stock of hard disks, basically. So the hard disks look like what Amazon wants them to look. So even if you don't care about Amazon, you have to care because your hardware is becoming more like what Amazon wants it to be. So you may end up having to design your system to operate more like they would on Amazon, actually. It has tremendous potential, mostly because when you have the whole infrastructure, you can actually look in and see what the systems are doing. So we were just talking about this before, that, you know, there are cloud providers where you have a database running, and from the outside, you can actually go into the VM, through the kernel of the database system, and figuring out what's going on, and even throttle it. You can even pause IO calls that you don't find. So this is a power that didn't exist before, and there's an active area of research. I mean, Amazon is also customizing hardware for MySQL, instance. Just because they run at such a big scale, they can afford to do that, right? So it makes it much easier to manage if you have a database, but it also is very interesting from the hardware side. Of course, there are issues with predictability and privacy that are still open. Now, just to finish up, I just want to pass the message that one size does not fit all. There has been a complete, you know, almost Cambrian explosion, literally research, column stores, arrays, MapReduce, NoSQL. There are systems going all over the place. I didn't talk about CPUs, I didn't talk about networking, not the system in there, which causes all kinds of disruption. So expect to see and to operate a zoo of database services. I mean, there's no conversions happening at any point soon. Of course, data integration becomes a growing problem when you have many systems that are operating independently. So expect more database services to move to the cloud, even database components to be deployed as a service. Not entire databases, but just specific parts or specific types of services that solve specific problems. More hardware-driven deployments. You know, it's been happening all around. It's going to get worse. I think that one should expect the DBMS paradigm, you know, declarative data processing, basically, to be widely adopted. I mean, if you look at a way to program parallel systems, DBMSs have been doing that for many years. Might not be ideal, but it's one that we know it works. We don't have any other good abstraction to work on very complex hardware, parallel hardware, and at least we have one that has been demonstrated to work with. Thank you.
Any questions for Miguel?
When you were talking about that, that the title of the cycle is so calm and easy, but you can fight on the market with the process of creating both slow and calm.
Well, there is a, so, there is, I didn't have just time to talk about it, I can give you some specific pointers, but there is some suggestions of systems that compose rows and columns in ways that, you know, all trying to minimize how much data you read. If you look at Exadata, it doesn't do that. And actually the algorithm behind Exadata called PAX was developed with our group a few years back. That actually made it into a product. There's other solutions that involve, you know, you have some in a piece of list, you have some in a row store, some in a column store, because you know that these ones you're going to update often, that's better at a row store. These ones you're going to read often, that's better at a column store. So the hybrids are about that, playing with it. It's a query optimization issue, so it's not a, but there's, I can point you to research on that.
Any further questions?
I have one. On the slide you were talking about writing your own query engine versus in the format that you have it.
Yeah.
How easy is it to integrate, and how would that solve the vendor locking problem?
Well,
you would still have to write specific.
So, it's sort of.
Summarize the question. Simple to do here.
Yes. Yeah. So the question is about this particular system. How easy it is to integrate, and if you have to write wrappers and the like. So the basic structure is sort of, think of it as a spatial index. If you lay out a file on a piece of paper, you can make a spatial index over the file, right? There's some parts to it that are file format specific. There's a big chunk that's totally independent of the format. And the point is exactly trying to isolate those two, because database engines have all sorts of assumptions all the way down to file format. And you can actually separate them into two nice abstractions.
Very easy and possible in the current system.
Yeah. So we do that for, we have two formats because that's what people ask. We have CSV, turns out it's quite common, and an astronomy file format called CIS, which is the mix of tables and the three-dimensional arrays.
Okay, so I propose if you have any further questions or anyway, if you want to hang around, we are going to restaurant 2 for a coffee and where we can have more discussion with Miguel. So let's thank Miguel again for his talk. Thank you, very good.